You are listening to the National Gang Center Podcast, Voices from the Field. In each episode, we hear from experts and go in-depth about their stories and experience with addressing gangs and communities. This program is supported by the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. The points of view and opinions expressed within do not necessarily represent those of the U.S. Department of Justice.
I'm Sean Baldwin with the National Gang Center, and I want to welcome our audience to this episode of our podcast, which is focused on interrupting the cycle of violence by identifying and leveraging opportunities for gang intervention. I'm being joined by Dr. David Pyruz, who is an associate professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and he is an expert in the criminology of social groups, and in particular, gangs. Dr. Pyruz is an active researcher, teaching professor, and author. He recently co-authored a book titled On Gangs. So along with some of his esteemed colleagues, he literally wrote the book on gangs. Dr. Pyruz, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you for having me on, Sean. I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
So you've been dedicating a lot of time to research and writing on gangs. I know that you've been traveling around the country and even internationally to speak on gangs. Why is it that this subject matter is so important to you?
I mean, it's a topic that we are interested in. You know, I'm a criminologist, but I can't help but have to look back at things like places, puzzles, people. Like for me, for example, you know, on the biographical side, you know, I grew up in an area where there was this rampant gang activity. And I know that's common for a lot of people. The difference for me was that I sort of experienced it in two places. One was where my mom lived in the Central Valley of California, sort of small town America with big city problems. And on the other side, there was my dad in San Jose, California, big city gang problems. And so if you come of age in the early 1990s, where there was a lot of violence in this country and a lot of it tied to gangs, these are observations that really stick with you. I think on the puzzle side, it's more about when I was going into graduate school, there were questions. Some of it was like theoretical, but some of it was practical or policy oriented. Like on the theoretical side, you know, people raised the question of, do gangs really affect crime and violence? And is it because of the group or is it because of the people? And so those debates sort of still raged as I was going into graduate school. And on the policy or practice side, it's, you know, how do you effectively respond to gangs? Like, what do you do to respond to them? Because I would venture to guess that most of your audience has encountered gang populations, and they know that there's an incredible amount of potential that's lost to people who grow up in those neighborhoods or get involved in gangs. And I think probably the last and perhaps the most important thing is the people. Working with Barbara Owen when I was a master's student at Fresno State, you know, I had this opportunity to insert questions in a survey instrument and then interview incarcerated people in the Fresno County Jail. And then probably the biggest push was being mentored by, you know, Scott Decker when I was getting my PhD at Arizona State. It just really gave me an opportunity to not only just design research, but to be able to execute it. And so those three things probably really stuck with me and motivated me to devote the bulk of my, you know, career so far to this topic.
Well, we appreciate all your effort, the research and the writing, but maybe sure. Even more so your ability to turn all of that into practical guidance for those that are working in the field. And that's something I think that we need to do a lot more of. And that's the reason why you're here with us today. So let's do some of that right now. Our objective is to help those working on community violence reduction identify opportunities for intervention. But I think we should start by stepping back and doing a brief review of why youth join gangs in the first place. Can you help us understand what drives youth toward gang involvement?
I think probably the best way to think about it is this idea of pushes and pulls. And so Scott Decker and Barrick Van Winkle, they wrote this book called Life in the Gang. It was published in 1996, and I still think it's as relevant today as it was back in 1996. It was about gangs in St. Louis, about the emergence of these gangs and so on. But the only reason I say that is because they're the ones who first coined this push-pull dynamic. And what that really means is when we're talking about pushes, you know, these are things that people experience that propel them toward the group. Adverse childhood experiences, school transitions, growing up in violent neighborhoods, and so on. And by pushes, these are all external to the gang. These are all things that bring someone or propel people toward the group. On the flip side, there are pulls. And pulls are what really entice people to join the gang. They're the things that make the gang appealing, regardless of whether the gang is able to deliver on it. It's, you know, things like the money or the economics. It's the protection or the safety, the companionship or identity. Those things are all internal to the group. I know in research language, we call these the selective incentives, the incentives for involvement in the gang. So there's no single one pathway. There's just no way to say that there is one tried and true pathway for a person to get involved. There's multiple different pathways, and it's probably most useful to think about them in terms of these pushes and these pulls.
So you've spoken about gang association as a trajectory, and I think that may help us understand the process of gang involvement. Can you explain this trajectory?
Sure. I mean, the way I like to think of it is there's this pre-gang period when all of those pushes and pulls really start to matter. There's the in-gang period, you know, the life in the gang. And then there's the post-gang period, life after the gang. And we could think about it as a trajectory or like a pathway of development, not unlike how sociologists or psychologists talk about trajectories of education, trajectories of family and of work, and so on. So for gangs, at least, you know, these trajectories really start to ramp up in the preteen to early teen years. They tend to peak in the mid-teen years, and they tend to tail off in either the late teen or early adulthood years.
I've seen that represented visually as a bell curve, right?
Yeah.
With three sections, pre-involvement, active involvement, and post-involvement.
I mean, it's never that clean, right? I mean, it's never like perfectly clean because there is some things like intermittency. You know, some people will join, you know, they'll sort of tail off their involvement and then something grabs them and pulls them back in.
I've heard some discussion recently about disengagement from gangs and how this is a process and not necessarily a single event that occurs suddenly. Do you find in your research that it takes time or that it's a process? And I think maybe that helps inform our goals in this intervention work. I hear people say that their goal is to get kids out of gangs, and the intervention workers will push back on that sometimes, saying, wait a minute, that takes time. It's a process. Maybe that shouldn't be the immediate goal. Maybe it should be reducing their involvement mm-hmm. in violence.
Yeah, there's sort of two takes, or I'll answer this in two different ways because I think it's important to clarify both of these points. But number one is you're absolutely right. It is a process. It is not an event. This is something that takes time. But let's here's sort of how I like to think about it. And I think that this sort of resonates with a lot of people. Think about the last relationship that you were in that resulted in a breakup. You know, the girlfriend, the husband, whatever it is. These relationships can unwind at very different paces. Some are quick, others are prolonged. And they could be spurred by a lot of different things. It could be infidelity. It could be moving. It could be the loss of a job. But the point I think is to say, and which relates to the gangs, is that there's variation. But when there are these binding ties, it is much more difficult to like unwind them. So, for example, with marriages, think of a marriage versus thinking of, you know, a romantic partnership, a girlfriend or a boyfriend versus an actual marriage. You know, when people are in a marriage, they tend to have houses and kids and pets, and they have all these other shared interests. You can't just snap your fingers and it's over. You know, there's processes that you have to go through to determine, you know, where the kids stay. There's legal processes even, you know, from selling a house to, you know, having a judge agree on the distribution of assets and so on. It's gradual. It's something that unwinds over time. So to bring this back to gangs, you know, why would leaving a group that has brought meaning to your life and that has, there's all of these relationships there, even if it has brought you all this strife, as plenty of marriages do, why would that be any different? So I think it's a long way of saying that when you're thinking about leaving gangs, there's a lot of generality to this. And by generality, what I mean is, like, it's similar processes to a whole host of, like, what we typically associate with, like, pro-social or positive things, like a marriage. But it's not just like relationship dissolution. It could also be like religious apostasy, where somebody starts moving away from a church. Those things take time too. Or even retirement. You know, those are roles or statuses that really help to define who we are and make us who we are. So asking somebody to change who they are is a big ask. And it's going to need a lot of support if you're trying to reorient someone.
And that makes sense. I want to move to dispelling some of the urban legends and myths around gang involvement. One of these myths is that youth from disadvantaged neighborhoods impacted by gangs are most likely going to end up joining gangs. What does the research tell us about this?
No, it's not true. This idea that, I mean, it's the flip. It's the opposite. Most of those kids from those communities don't join gangs. And let me give you an example. So like in Rochester, New York, there was the Rochester Youth Development Study. It was funded by the U.S. Department of Justice. Some of the best criminologists in the field over at SUNY Albany, they conducted this multi-wave study. And one of the things that they did, and by multi-way, let me say, they interviewed these kids, you know, in their middle school years, and they followed them up, interviewing them biannually and annually through up until early adulthood. One of the things that they did, though, was they purposely selected youth from high crime communities. Do you want to guess what proportion of those kids ended up joining gangs by the time they were adults? 30%. So I don't know where the audience would have guessed ultimately. I would venture to say that 30% would have been somewhat low. And a lot of times people think that just because a kid grows up in a neighborhood where there's a lot of violence and crime or gang activity, that those kids are the ones, or all of those kids are going to end up in gangs. Now, many of those kids will have some associations by virtue of their family or the school they attend or neighbors, or just that's how friendship formation works. You associate with the people who you live around, but they don't identify with the group. They don't say, I'm a member of this group, and they don't necessarily go to battle with that group. So it's important to distinguish between the kids who get involved in the gangs and then those who don't. That's partly identity, but it's also their embeddedness in the group.
I've seen this in my 25 years working in law enforcement. I've worked in neighborhoods severely impacted by gangs. And it just amazes me how some of these kids grow up in these neighborhoods and just go on to achieve just incredible success in life. Mm-hmm. So another myth is that once you're in a gang, you can't get out. You're in it for life. So what's the research say about that?
I mean, the research is very inconsistent with that. You know, there were a lot of, you know, Hollywood movies that were made in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And, you know, your audience has probably seen a fair amount of them, from, you know, Blood In, Blood Out, or American Me, or Colors, Menace to Society. So all those types of movies. And it sort of left this impression, you know, for one, it's sort of like this, you know, psychopathological view of gang members, for one. For two, it was like this lifelong commitment, like the title, Blood In, Blood Out. But the vast majority of people, and I say vast very strongly, who join a gang ultimately leave. You know, not far from where my dad lived in San Jose, the district attorney over there, they plastered these billboards. And on the billboard, it was a picture of a cemetery. And on the side, it said, the gang has a special place for your kids. So it's a really powerful message. It's black and white. You know, it's sort of cloudy, and it's just, it really leaves a strong message. And I don't want to discount the consequences because they are very real. Like, so for example, in St. Louis, what we found, police identified black male gang members. They had an annual homicide victimization rate of 950 per 100,000. That's 200 times greater than the general population. That's 50 times greater than all males in the United States at that time. So yes, there are absolutely consequences, but those consequences are not representative of the experiences of all the people who get involved in gangs. So what you find in the longitudinal research, people leave regularly. And in fact, they're typically only involved for a couple of years. But when we're interviewing prison gang members in Texas, prison gang members in other places, they're also leaving too. And they're leaving in prison, what we think of as like the total institution, the controlled environment where gangs have the most power and influence. And people are able to leave their affiliations behind even there.
Thank you for clearing that up. And that helps us bring us to our focus for today, identifying opportunities for intervention. So you mentioned that youth are driven to join gangs by these pushes and pulls. Are there similar factors that motivate disengagement from gangs?
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile to think of disengagement sort of as a reversal of the pushes and pulls for joining. So the pushes now are internal to the group rather than external. So those pushes, those are the things that pushed people towards the gang. Now it's the experiences that occur within the group that's now pushing people out. So this could be the violence that they're experiencing. It could be personal violence, so things that happen to them, but also vicarious violence, things that happen to their close friends, their fellow gang members. It could be the politics of the group, seeing them behave in a way that is inconsistent with what they've been told. Or seeing, the criminal justice consequences. In prison, for example, the inability to get paroled was a strong push. They wanted to get back and to see their family. But, these paroles were continued to be denied because of their gang affiliations. So, all of these things, these pushes are what lead people to start feel discontent with the group. Now, there's the pulls. The pulls are now external. These are all the things that are orbiting around the gang, that are outside of the group. These are the girlfriends, the children, the jobs, other things that can act as hooks for change, that can sort of like start to pull people out. Now, the thing that's important, though, is like pushes, what we find in the research, and this is consistent. It doesn't matter if you're studying teenagers or studying adults or in prison or on the street. The pushes tend to matter more than the pulls do. But when they're both aligned in the same direction, when you have the pulls in place and the pushes, that's when people tend to be most successful and most likely to ultimately leave the gang.
Are there circumstances that you've been able to identify that might drive a deeper or prolonged period of gang involvement?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, to be completely frank, there's not a lot of research on this. There's been a couple of studies, but like some of the research, it points to things that are probably mostly like they're irrelevant to your audience. So if you focus on someone's race or ethnicity or sex or, individual characteristic, that doesn't help too much to say that, people with these demographics stay longer. It's got to be things that you could change, things that you could manipulate in favor of supporting someone. The one thing that I think is pretty consistent with prolonging involvement, at least I think that there's some pretty powerful evidence to show it, is incarceration. When people go to jail, when they go to prison, in juvenile lockup even, oftentimes it either initiates someone's involvement for the first time in their life or intensifies their involvement if they bring their gang affiliation into the institution. Some of this is out of necessity. Some of this is out of exposure, and some of this is out of status enhancement. But I think that's where we see probably the most evidence to suggest of something that will prolong someone's involvement. Violence, it's too inconsistent. You know, we think of violence as being like cohesion building in gangs. So oftentimes when a gang gets attacked, you know, it brings the group together to act as a unit. But also violence could be cohesion breaking, where it leads the group, or at least some members of the group, to start to look elsewhere.
That's interesting. When I started my career in law enforcement 30 years ago, the only real solution to the gang problem was to go out and arrest all the gang members and put them away as long as we could. And while I still believe that enforcement is necessary to mm-hmm. protect our community from violent offenders, I know that we can't arrest our way out of the problem. As you point out, incarceration may just make the problem worse by extending gang involvement. We must take a balanced approach that includes not only enforcement, but mm-hmm. intervention and prevention. And that's why it's so important that we're having these conversations today. So when you talk about pushes and pulls, it sounds like you're talking about life course events, things that will happen in some cases in anybody's life, having children, relationships, traumatic events. Can you explain how intervention workers can leverage these life course events or identify these opportunities to intervene? What should they be looking for as they're doing their job every day?
Sure. And let me step back. I'm going to answer the question, but I think it's worthwhile to step back first and then to initially pose the question of like on the efficacy of interventions in the first place. So a lot of times when it comes to gangs, you sort of hear this mantra of nothing works because, you know, there isn't a lot of evaluation on these topics. And maybe 15 years ago, we could probably say, okay, we don't really know what works very well, but at least in 2022, you know, we do have a better sense on prevention or intervention, even suppression activities that do work better or worse. What we don't really know is what works, or at least works that well, when it comes to supporting disengagement from gangs. So to me, the first question is, can these interventions work in the first place? And I think so. But there does remain the question of how well they work over and above the natural social processes that you just mentioned. Because what we don't want is our interventions to backfire. We don't want our interventions to make things worse and to push a kid towards the gang or assign a label that sticks, like those scarlet letters of involvement. And there is some debate about this, and I don't want to get too academic on this, but I do think that it's worthwhile to mention at least part of it. There's this term called desistance by default versus that somebody actively makes the change. Like they go through like a cognitive transformation in who they are. So desistance by default means you didn't even have to try and you left. It just so happened that your girlfriend showed up. It just so happened that, you know, the dice rolled in your favor and you had some good luck that propelled you or pulled you away from the gang. The identity transformation does take work. You have to try. You have to actively undertake certain steps to get out of the group. And so I think the reason why this matters, and I think a lot of your audience could relate to this, is, you know, what is it about this violent event that you experienced that was made different versus all of these other prior experiences that did not get you out of the group? Because we can't just say violence works to get somebody out of the gang. I mean, we obviously don't want to promote that in the first place. But on the flip side, children. So what you find is for girls, young women who have children, it almost universally leads them out. I mean, their rate of involvement just tanks. For boys, young men, it depends on whether or not they live with their child. If they live with their child, they're far less likely to stay involved in the gang. If they don't, they're more likely to remain involved. But the point that I'm trying to make here is it's not necessarily that first kid. It could have been the second kid. So what is it that leads somebody with that second child to get them to want to use that to promote their disengagement from gangs? Because you can't just say it's by default if they have to actively use it to get out. So to bring this full circle, to be able to advise people who are working with these populations, it's being able to discern these opportunities or this openness for change. And it's getting people to either rethink, you know, the meaning of the group to them, or getting them, if they already have that openness, getting them to use it as like this strong and costly signal that people could understand and relate to as a means to get them out of the group. So let me pause there first, and Sean, and see if you have any questions about that, because I know I went on for a little bit here.
Understanding that this research is really tough to do, where are we at on the evidence that intervention work is effective in assisting people through this path of disengagement?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit too early to tell at this point. I mean, we're still at some of the early stages. I mean, I think there's some pretty good evidence on violence interruption. It's more of the caseload approach that's not exactly clear at this point. You know, where you assign a street outreach worker to work with a kid who's involved in gangs and then use that street outreach worker to facilitate their exit out. We're not exactly sure at this point in time, but, you know, anecdotal evidence would say yes. I mean, you know, the way that street outreach is able to sort of, you know, poke holes in the story and like the logics of gang myths. So, for example, you know, when we talk about like the pushes and pulls for or really the pulls for joining, like, why is it that people want to get involved in a gang? Well, you hear things like, you know, the money, the companionship, the safety. Well, not all kids realize this, but the street outreach worker who's been there and experienced can say, well, tell me how much money you've made. Tell me what this gang has done for you to support you economically. Tell me what the companionship when, you know, somebody's snitching on you or somebody doesn't have your back. How many people were there to visit you when you got locked up last time? How many people wrote you letters when you were locked up last time? Or the safety, you know, tell me exactly how the gang made you safer in this violent environment. And so posing questions like that is something I don't know if the police can necessarily do it the best. I don't know if the teachers could be the best at it or the social workers or so on. It does feel like something where outreach is uniquely positioned to be able to get, you know, kids and young people involved in gangs to really rethink those things, to understand that they've been sold a bill of goods, that these are just promises that gangs typically can't keep.
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to talk with people that have been able to move away mm-hmm. from gangs and become successful. And most point out that they had an outreach worker, a mentor, a coach, someone that stepped in to help them see a better path and even just remove barriers like not having a driver's license, completing high school, those issues that you just can keep them from moving forward.
But Sean, let me add, I don't think it's outreach alone. Because a lot of people, especially who've been there for in the long term in gangs, you know, there are just some historical traumas, some childhood traumas that you need some experienced professionals to be able to work with some of these kids. And a lot of these outreach workers have unmet needs, too, with some of these traumas, too. So it's also being able to support your outreach workers and to get them the support that they need to be able to help change kids for the better.
That's really an important point, is taking care of that trauma and actually including that in your program design is absolutely essential for any intervention program. So Dr. Pyrouz, what's your best advice for those involved in community violence intervention efforts? What should they be focusing their attention on?
I think one of the things we should be really focused on, and I would imagine that this would resonate at least for people who are at the line level on the street who are, you know, observing these activities, it's that we should be focusing less on trying to change someone's identity and more focused on trying to reduce their embeddedness in the gang. And by embeddedness, I'm really referring to their immersion. So identity is a part of it. Their position in the group is a part of it. But really, it's about their behaviors, right? Because the gang wouldn't really matter, or it wouldn't be a law enforcement criminal justice priority if it weren't for the elevated involvement in violence, in offending and delinquency and intimidation and so on. So if we could reduce some of the gang behaviors, at least those that are law violating or deviant, you know, those are the things that we should be really focused on. And I'd venture to guess that a lot of people who are listening could relate to some of this when they've interacted with, you know, veteran OG gang members who sort of still claim the identity. It's a fixture of who they are, but their behaviors are very incongruent. You know, they tend to be more family men or, you know, workers or, you know, churchgoers. In other words, their identity in the gang is just a small part of who they are. The rest of their identity is a lot more nuanced than what you could think of as, like, you know, conventional masculinity, I guess, if you will. And this applies to women too. Like on occasion, you know, people like this could be on the block, but they aren't necessarily embedded or banging. And so, you know, if we could work to try to reduce some of that more unstructured socializing that occurs, and sort of those norms towards resolving disputes, whether it's individual or collective disputes among groups, violently, that would go a long way to, like, bringing people, you know, not like it helps them disengage from gangs, but it would be a long way to accomplishing some of our overarching goals of trying to sort of maximize the potential that a lot of these young people have.
That is really good advice. Dr. Pyrous, thank you for breaking all of this research down for us and providing some really practical and helpful guidance for those that are working in the field doing this intervention work. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure, and I always enjoy talking with you, Sean. And, you know, I appreciate all the good work that you all do to help translate the research to practice as well.
Yeah, and thank you. For our audience, if you'd like to hear more from Dr. Pyrous, I encourage you to view Understanding Gang Involvement, a recorded webinar on the National Gang Center's YouTube channel. I'd also encourage you to visit the National Gang Center's website, where you'll find a host of resources designed to help communities overcome youth gang problems.
The National Gang Center is committed to informing, equipping, and training communities to prevent gang violence, reduce gang involvement, and suppress gang-related crime. For additional information regarding the National Gang Center, visit nationalgangcenter.ojp.gov, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or send us an email at information@nationalgangcenter.gov.